Chapter 9. Professor Treadwell seemed restless. Her face was calm as ever, but as the students worked, she paced back and forth across the auditorium stage, the heels of her shoes making a repetitive click. Artie poked Charlie, nodded toward the professor, and quickly mimed screaming. Charlie smiled and turned back to her own work. She didn't mind the sound. The professor's sharp, regular steps were like a metronome, marking the time. She reread the first question. Describe the difference between a conditional loop and an infinite loop. Charlie sighed. She knew the answer, it just seemed pointless to write it down. A conditional loop happens only when certain conditions, she started, then scratched it out and sighed again, staring out over the heads of the other students. She could see the face of the wolf again, shimmering back and forth between its two faces, the illusion and the frame beneath it. Its eyes stared into her own, as if reading something deep inside her. Who are you? Who were you supposed to be? She thought. She had never seen it before, and it worried her. Freddy Fazbear's Pizza didn't have a wolf. Charlie had a near photographic memory, she'd realized last year. It was the reason she had such recall of even her early childhood. But she didn't remember the wolf. That's silly, she told herself. There's plenty you don't remember. And yet her memories of her father's workshop were so strong. The smell, the heat. Her father bent over his workbench, and the place in the corner where she didn't like to look. It was all so present within her, so immediate. Even the things she didn't remember without prompting, like the old Fred Bear's family diner, had been instantly familiar as soon as she'd seen them. Yet these creatures had no foothold in her memory. She didn't know them, but they clearly knew her. Why were they entombed in the back of the house like that? Why not just destroyed? Her father's deep attachment to his creations had never outweighed his pragmatism. If something didn't work, he dismantled it for parts. He had done the same with Charlie's own toys. She blinked, suddenly recalling. He held it out to her, a little green frog with horn-rimmed glasses over its bulging eyes. Charlie looked at it skeptically. No, she said.
Don't you want to see what he does? Her father protested, and she crossed her arms and shook her head.
No, she mumbled. I don't like the big eyes. Despite her protests, her father set the frog on the ground in front of her and pressed a button hidden beneath the plastic at its neck. It rotated its head from side to side, then suddenly leaped in the air. Charlie screamed and jumped back, and her father rushed to pick her up.
I'm sorry, sweetheart. It's okay, he whispered. I didn't mean for it to startle you.
I don't like the eyes, she sobbed against his neck, and he held her for a long moment, then set her down and picked up the frog. He put it on its workbench, took a short knife from the shelf, and sliced its skin along its entire length. Charlie clapped a hand over her mouth and made a small, squeaking sound, watching wide-eyed as he carelessly peeled the green casing off the robot. The plastic split with a loud cracking noise in the quiet workshop. The frog's legs kicked helplessly.
I didn't mean it, she said hoarsely. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. Daddy!
She was speaking aloud, but it was mostly air. Her voice was somehow constrained, like in dreams where she tried to scream, but nothing came out. Her father was intent on his work and didn't seem to hear her. The stripped-down robot lay prone before him on the bench. He prodded it, and it made a horrible twitch, its back legs kicking out uselessly, repeating the motion of its leap into the air. It tried again, more frantically, like it was in pain.
Wait, Daddy, don't hurt him,
Charlie mouthed, trying and failing to force out the sound. Her father selected a tiny screwdriver and began to work at the frog's head, deftly unscrewing something on each side. He removed the back of the skull to reach inside. Its whole body convulsed. Charlie ran to her father's side and grabbed his leg, tugging at the knee of his pants.
"Please,"
she cried, her voice returning. He disconnected something, and the skeleton went completely limp. Joints that had been stiff collapsed into a slump of parts. The eyes, which Charlie had not even noticed were lit, dimmed, flickered, and went dark. She let go of her father and moved back into the recess of the workshop, putting both hands over her mouth again so that he would not hear her cry as he began to methodically dismantle the frog. Charlie shook her head, pulling herself back to the present. The child's guilt still clung to her, like a weight in her chest. She gently pressed her hand there. "My father was pragmatic," she thought. "Parts were expensive, and he didn't waste them on things that didn't work." She forced her mind to the problem at hand. So why would he have buried them alive?
"Buried who alive?"
Artie hissed, and she turned, startled.
"Shouldn't you be busy doing something?"
she said hastily, mortified to have spoken aloud. The creatures had been buried in a chamber like a mausoleum, hidden in the walls of the house. Her father hadn't wanted to destroy them for some reason, and he had wanted them nearby. Why? So he could keep an eye on them? Or did he even know they were there? Did Dave somehow hide them there without his knowledge? She shook her head. It didn't matter. What mattered was what the creatures were going to do next. She closed her eyes again, trying to envision the wolf-like creature. She'd only seen it for that moment as it disgorged the woman inside it and hovered between states, its illusion flickering like a faulty light bulb. Charlie held on to the image, kept it frozen in her mind. She'd been fixated first on the victim, then on the wolf's eyes, but she had still seen the rest of it. Now she pictured the scene, ignoring the wolf's gaze, ignoring the panic that had seized her, the others shouting and running around her. She watched it happen again and again, picturing the chest sliding open one tooth-like rib at a time, then the woman falling out. She realized she had a better picture of the same thing stored away, the creature in the tomb, just before it tried to swallow her. She visualized its chest opening, searching her mind to see what lay beyond the hideous mouth, inside the cavernous chest. Then she bent her head over her exam book and began to draw.
"Time,"
called one of the graduate students. The other three began to march up the aisles, collecting blue books one by one. Charlie only had half a sentence in answer to the first question, and it was crossed out. The rest of the book was a mess of mechanisms and monsters. Just before the teaching assistant reached her, she quietly tucked the book under her arm. She exited the row, blending in with the students who had already finished. She didn't speak to anyone on the way out, drifting more than walking, focused on her own thoughts as her body carried her aimlessly down the familiar hallway. She found a bench and sat. She looked around at the passing students, chatting to one another or lost in thoughts of their own. It was as if a wall had risen up, circling only her, completely isolating her from everything around her. She opened her book again, to the page where she'd spent her test time scribbling. There, staring back at her, were the faces she understood, the faces of monsters and murderers, with blank eyes that pierced right through her, even from her own sketches.
"What are you trying to tell me?"
She stood, clenching her book, then took one last look at her surroundings. It felt as though she were saying goodbye to a chapter of her life, another passage that would become nothing more than a haunting memory.
"Charlie,"
John's voice said from nearby. She glanced around, trying to find him through the thick flow of students exiting the building. She finally spotted him off to the side of the stairs.
Oh, hey, she called and made her way over. What are you doing here?
Not that I'm not glad to see you, I just thought you had to work, she added hastily, trying to settle the whirling thoughts in her head.
Clay called me. He tried your dorm, but you were here, I guess. The woman we... from last night. She's going to be okay. He said he went to the next area, the next spot on the map, and drove around.
John glanced at the crowd of students streaming past them and lowered his voice.
You know, the next place they're going to.
I know, Charlie said quickly, forestalling the explanation. What did he find?
Well, it's a lot of empty space and fields, mostly. One plot for future development, but it's vacant. He thinks we should focus on tomorrow instead. He has a plan.
Charlie looked at him blankly.
We're going to have to fight them, he said at last. We both know that. But it won't be tonight.
Charlie nodded. So what do we do tonight, then? She asked helplessly.
Dinner?
John suggested.
You can't be serious.
Charlie's tone dropped.
I know there's a lot going on, but we still need to eat, right?
Charlie stared at the ground, collecting her thoughts.
Sure, dinner.
She smiled.
This is all pretty awful. It might be nice to get my mind off it, even if just for an evening.
Okay,
he said, and shifted awkwardly.
I'm going to run home and change then. I won't be long.
John, none of this has to involve you, Charlie said softly.
She gripped the straps of her backpack with both hands, as if they were tethering her to the ground.
What are you talking about?
John looked at her, his self-consciousness gone.
It doesn't have to involve anybody. It's me they're looking for.
We don't know that for sure, he said, and put a hand on her shoulder. You have to get that out of your head for a while. You'll drive yourself crazy.
John smiled briefly, but he still looked worried.
Try to do something relaxing for a bit. Take a nap or something. I'll see you for dinner, okay? Same restaurant at 7?
Okay, she echoed.
He looked at her helplessly and gave a distressed smile, then turned and went. Jessica was gone when Charlie got back to the dorm. She closed the door behind her with a sense of relief. She needed quiet. She needed to think, and she needed to move. She looked around, paralyzed for a moment. Her system of piling everything up as she used it was functional day to day, but when searching for something she hadn't touched in weeks, the system broke down.
Where is it?
She muttered, scanning the room. Her eyes lit on Theodore's head, lying tumbled up against the leg of her bed. She picked it up and brushed off the dust, stroking his long ears until they were clean, if matted and patchy.
You used to be so soft, she told the rabbit's head.
She set it on the bed, propped up on her pillow.
I guess I did too, she added, and sighed. Have you seen my duffel bag?
She asked the dismembered toy.
Maybe under the bed?
She got down on her knees to check. It was there, all the way at the far side, crushed by a pile of books and clothing that had fallen through the space between the bed and the wall. Charlie wriggled under the bed until she could snag the strap, then dragged it out and set it on top. It was empty. She dumped out the contents as soon as she arrived, a harbinger of the messy habits to follow. She grabbed her toothbrush and toothpaste and zipped them into the bag's side pocket.
I lied to John, she said. No, that's not right. I let him lie to me. He has to know it's me they're coming for. We all do. And this isn't going to stop.
She picked up clothing from what she thought was the clean pile, pulling out a t-shirt and jeans, socks and underwear, and shoving them emphatically into her bag as she spoke. Why else would they be coming in this direction? She asked the rabbit. But how would they even know? She threw two textbooks into the bag and patted her pocket, reassuring herself that the disc and the diagnostic keyboard were there. She zipped up the bag and tilted her head, meeting Theodore's plastic eyes. It's not just that, she said. This thing. She measured the disc in her hand and studied it anew. It made John sick, but it sings a song to me. She broke off, unsure of what that meant about her. I don't know if I've ever known anything with quite such certainty, she said quietly. But I have to do this. Afton made them, and Afton took Sammy. When I was with John, I could feel something in the house. It had to be him. It was like the missing part of me was there, closer than it had ever been. I just couldn't quite reach it. And I think those monsters are the only things in the world that might have answers. Theodore stared back at her, unmoved. It's me they want. No one else is going to die because of me. She sighed. At least I have you to protect me, right? She slung the bag over her back and turned to go, then paused. She grabbed Theodore's head by the ears and held him up to her own eye level. I think today I need all the support I can get, she whispered. She shoved him into her bag, then hurried out of the dorm to her car. The map was in the glove compartment. Charlie took it out and spread it in front of her, glancing at it momentarily, then putting it away with confidence. She drove slowly out of the lot. Though she passed people and other cars on her way, she felt as though she was just part of the background, unseen to the world. By the time she and her car slipped out of sight, she'd already be forgotten. The sky was cloudy. It gave the world a sense of waiting. It seemed like Charlie had the road to herself, and peacefulness overtook her. She'd been preoccupied with isolation today, but the speed and openness were comforting. She didn't feel alone. The tree line seemed to race across the field when she watched it from the window, an illusion made by the speeding car. She began to feel as though there were something in the woods matching her speed, darting through the blur of branches, a silent companion, someone coming to tell her everything that she ever wanted to know. I'm coming, she whispered. The street dwindled from a highway to a country road, then to a gravel path. It rose up a long hill, and as Charlie slowly ascended, she could see clusters of houses and cars in distant, more populated areas. She turned a corner and left it all behind. There were no more houses, no more cars. The rows of trees had been replaced with lines of stumps and piles of brush, accompanied by the occasional blank billboard that, presumably, would someday announce what was to come. Slabs of concrete and half-paved driveways interrupted the countryside, and an abandoned bulldozer sat in the distance. Charlie took Theodore's head from her bag and set it on the passenger seat. Stay alert, she said. Then she saw it. A single ranch-style house stood at the center of it all, surrounded by bulldozed land and the bare rib cages of half-built houses jutting from the ground. It was out of place, painted, fenced, and even planted with flowers in the garden. That's when it made sense. A show house. The road stopped a few yards into the development, replaced by worn-down tracks in the dirt where the machinery came in and out. Charlie slowed the car to a stop. Even you can't follow me this time, she said to the rabbit's head, then got out and closed the door, giving Theodore a smile through the window. Charlie walked the trail slowly. The hulking, unfinished frames of the houses seemed to watch her reproachfully as she trespassed. The gravel crunched under her feet in the silence. There wasn't even a breeze. Everything was still. She stopped when she reached higher ground and surveyed her surroundings for a moment. Everything was disturbed. Everything was upturned. She glanced above her as a single bird passed overhead, barely visible from its soaring height. Her eyes returned to the wasteland. You're here somewhere, aren't you? At last she reached the lone, finished house. It was set at the center of a neat square of perfectly trimmed grass, towering above its stooped, half-constructed neighbors. Charlie stared at the lawn for a moment before realizing that it must be fake, just like whatever furniture was inside. She didn't try the door right away, instead going around to the backyard. It was laid out in a neat square of astroturf, just like the front, but here the illusion had been ruined. Ragged strips of grass had been torn up. The place radiated a sense of distress, now eerily familiar. Charlie just stared for a moment, certainty pulsing through her. She clenched her jaw, then went back around to the front door. It opened easily, without even a whisper of sound, and Charlie went inside. It was dark in the house. She flipped a light switch experimentally, and it illuminated the whole place in an instant. A fully furnished living room greeted her, complete with leather chairs and a couch, and even candles on the fireplace mantel. She started to close the front door behind her, then hesitated, leaving it ajar. She walked farther into the living room, where there was an L-shaped couch and a widescreen TV. I'm surprised it hasn't been stolen, she thought. But when she went closer, she saw why. It wasn't real. There were no cords or cables coming from it. The whole place had a surreal quality, almost of mockery. She walked slowly into the dining room, her feet clapping against the polished hardwood floor. Inside was a beautiful, mahogany dining set. Charlie bent over to look at the underside of the table. Balsa wood, she said, grinning to herself. It was a light, airy wood, made for model airplanes, not furniture. She could probably lift the table over her head if she wanted to. Down a short hallway from the dining room was a kitchen with gleaming new appliances, or at least imitations of them. There was also a back door in the kitchen. She unlocked it and pushed it open halfway, leaning outside and looking again at the expansive, tortured landscape. There were several stone steps here, leading down into a small garden. She stepped back inside, being sure to leave the door hanging slightly open. There was a second long hall off the living room. This led to bedrooms and a small room fashioned into an office or den, complete with tall bookshelves, a desk, and an inbox tray full of empty file folders. Charlie sat down in the desk chair, finding herself enchanted by the utterly surface imitation of life. She spun the chair once, then stood again, not wanting to get distracted. There was a door to the outside here, too, though it was oddly placed beside the desk. Charlie opened it, fiddling with the latch until she was sure it would stay open. She continued on her way, walking through the house systematically, unlocking and opening each window she came to. Then she went down to the basement, where a storm cellar hung over a set of steep stone stairs. She opened that as well, leaving the doors gaping wide. Outside, dark had fallen. There were several bedrooms, each furnished and made up with bright curtains and silk sheets, and a large bathroom with marble sinks. Charlie turned the faucet to see if there was water, but nothing happened, not even the grinding of pipes trying and failing. There was a master bedroom with an enormous bed, a guest room that somehow looked even less lived in than the rest of the house, and a nursery with a life-size menagerie painted on the wall and a mobile hanging above a crib. Charlie glanced inside each, then went back into the master bedroom. The bed was wide and covered in a light canopy of white mosquito netting. The covers were white as well, and the moon shone through the window to illuminate the pillows. It had an uncanny effect, as if whoever slept there would be on display. Charlie went to the window and leaned out, breathing in the soothing, cool night air. She looked up at the sky. It was still cloudy. There were only a few stars visible. She'd been moving with such grim, impulsive energy until now, but this part would be agonizing. Long hours might pass before anything happened, and all she could do was wait. A nervous fluttering had begun to fill her stomach. She wanted to pace, or even to run away, but she closed her eyes and clenched her jaw. It's me they want. At last, Charlie pulled herself away from the window. She'd packed pajamas in the bag out in the car, but this sterile house full of props and imitations felt too strange for her to actually dress for bed. Instead, she just took off her sneakers and considered her bedtime rituals complete. She laid down on the bed and tried to conjure her nightmares, gathering up those final moments with Sammy and holding them close to her like a talisman. Hold on, she thought. I'm coming. John checked his watch. She's just running late, but she was late last time, too. The waitress caught his eye, and he shook his head. Of course, last time she showed up covered in filth. He'd already called her dorm room, but the phone just rang and rang. He'd seen what he'd thought was an answering machine when he was there, but realized only as he was waiting for it to pick up that it could have been one of Charlie's projects, or some piece of discarded junk. The waitress refilled his water glass, and he smiled at her. She shook her head. Same girl? She asked gently. John let out an involuntary laugh. Yes, same girl, he said. But it's okay. She's not standing me up. She's just busy. College life, you know? Of course. Let me know if you want to order. She gave him another look of pity and went away. He shook his head. Suddenly, he saw Charlie's hands on her backpack straps, holding on so tight that her knuckles had gone white. They're coming for me, she'd said. Charlie wasn't the type to wait around patiently for something to happen to her. He got up and walked urgently to the payphone at the back of the restaurant. Clay picked up on the first ring. Clay, it's John. Have you heard from Charlie? No. What's wrong? Nothing, John said reflexively. I mean, I don't know. She was supposed to meet me, and she's 24 minutes late. I know it's not a lot, but she said something earlier that's bothering me. I think she might do something stupid. Where are you? John gave him the address. I'll be right there, Clay said, and hung up before John could reply. Chapter 10. For the first few minutes, Charlie kept her eyes shut, feigning sleep, but after a little while they began to flutter of their own accord. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to force them to stay closed, but it became unbearable. She opened them into the darkness and at once felt relief. The house had grown cool with night. The open window let in fresh, clean air. She breathed deeply, trying with each exhalation to make herself calm. She wasn't anxious so much as impatient. Hurry up, she thought. I know you're out there. But there was only silence and stillness. She took the disc out of her pocket and looked at it. It was too dark to see any details, not that there was anything on it she hadn't already memorized. A little light shone in from the moon outside, but the shadows in the corners were deep, like there was something hidden there, eating up the light. She rubbed the side of the disc with her thumb, feeling the bumps of the letters. If she didn't know they were there, they'd be scarcely noticeable. Afton Robotics, LLC. She'd seen pictures of William Afton, the man who Dave had been, pictures of him with her father, smiling and laughing. But she only remembered him as the man in the rabbit suit. My father must have trusted him. He must not have suspected. He would never have built a second restaurant with the man who murdered one of his children. But those creatures, he had to have known they were buried beneath our house. Charlie clenched her teeth, stifling a sudden delirious urge to smile. Of course there was a secret robot graveyard under my bedroom, she murmured. Of course that's where it would be. She covered her face in her hands. All the threads were tangling in her mind. She pictured it unwillingly. The creature in the doorway. At first he was a shadow, blocking the light. Then he was a man in a rabbit suit. And even then it didn't occur to Charlie to be afraid. She knew this rabbit. Sammy hadn't even noticed him yet. He continued to play with his toy truck, running it back and forth hypnotically across the floor. Charlie stared up at the thing in the doorway, and a coldness began to gather in the pit of her stomach. This was not the rabbit she knew. Its eyes shifted back and forth subtly between the twins, taking its time, making its choice. When the eyes settled on Charlie, the cold feeling spread all through her. Then he looked away again, at Sammy, who still hadn't turned around. Then a sudden movement, and the costumes on their hangers all leaped together, covering her so she couldn't see. She heard the toy truck hit the ground and spin in place for a moment. Then everything was still. She was alone, a vital part of her cut away. Charlie sat up, shaking herself to try and set the memories loose. She'd grown accustomed to sharing a room with Jessica. It was a long time since she'd been completely alone with her thoughts in the dark. I forgot how hard it is to be quiet, she whispered, her voice as soft as breath. She glared down at the strange disc in her hand, as if it was bringing these visions on her. She tossed it across the room and into a dark corner, out of sight. Then she heard it. Something was inside the house. Whatever it was being cautious. She heard creaks from somewhere distant, but they were slow and muted. Silence followed. Whatever moved was hoping the sound would be forgotten. Charlie crept from the bed and approached the door carefully, pushing it farther open and leaning out agonizingly slowly until she could see deep into the living room and the dining room beyond that. A part of her kept returning to the thought that she was in someone else's house, that she was the intruder. Hello? She called, almost hoping for an answer, even an angry one demanding to know what she was doing there. Maybe John would answer, happy to have found her, and come running from the darkness. Only silence returned her call, but Charlie knew she wasn't alone anymore. Her eyes widened, her heartbeat drumming in her throat, making it hard to breathe. She took careful steps over the stone tiles, down the short hall to just outside the living room, where she stood to listen again. A clock chimed the hours in a different room. Charlie walked to the edge of the living room and stopped again. She could see most of the house from here, and she scanned the area for anything out of place. Doorways surrounded her like gaping mouths, breathing night air from the windows she'd opened. There was a long hall leading from the farthest corner of the living room to a different bedroom. It was one of the few places she didn't have a clear line of sight into. She edged around the leather sofa in front of her and across the circular rug that filled the room. As she walked, she could see more of the hall slowly revealing itself. It stretched out, farther and farther. Charlie stopped mid-step. She could see into the far bedroom now. It was full of windows and blue moonlight, and there was something obstructing her view, something she hadn't noticed while she was moving. Now its silhouette was unmistakable. Charlie carefully looked around again, her eyes adjusting to her surroundings. To her right, another large door led down a single step and into the large den. Bookcases stretched up to the ceiling, and a putrid air emanated from inside. Beyond the bookcases was another shadow that didn't belong. Charlie bumped into a lamp and startled. She hadn't even realized she was moving backward. The front door was open wide. Charlie nearly bolted toward it to escape, but she stopped herself. She took a breath and stepped softly back toward the bedroom, checking over her shoulder as she went. She went back to the bed, sliding her bare feet on the wood floor so her steps would make no sound, and eased herself slowly onto the mattress, cautious to keep the springs from creaking. Charlie lay back, closed her eyes, and waited. Her eyes twitched, every instinct she had shouting the same thing. Open your eyes. Run. Charlie breathed steadily in and out, trying to make her body go limp, trying to look asleep. Something is moving. She counted the steps. One, two, one, two. No. They were slightly asynchronous. There was more than one of them. Two, maybe all three, were inside the house. One set of footsteps passed her door, and she let her eyes flutter open for an instant, just in time to see an indistinct shadow cross before the crack in the door. Another set of footsteps sounded like they were in the side hallway, while a third. She screwed her eyes shut tight. The steps fell still outside her door. Her breath was shuddering. She almost hiccuped as she inhaled and she bit her lips together. The door was gliding open. Her lungs tightened, pressing her for air, but she refused. She hung on to that single breath as if it were the last one she'd ever get. I'll find you. She clenched her fists, determined to remain still. The footsteps were through the door now, crossing the floor with a heavy tread. She kept still. The air above her stirred, and through her closed eyelids, the darkness grew even darker. Charlie opened her eyes and breathed in. The space above her was empty. Nothing was looking down at her. She turned her head slowly, peering into the open hall to her left. The noises had all stopped. Suddenly, the blankets were yanked off her, pulled from the foot of the bed. Charlie shot up and finally saw what had come for her. An enormous head rested its chin at her feet. It looked like something from a carnival game, its eyes rolling from side to side, clicking each time they moved. A pitch black top hat was perched on its head, cocked slightly to one side, and the giant cheeks and button nose gave him away immediately. Freddy. It was no longer the sleek and featureless head she had unearthed in the abandoned lot. His head was lively and full of movement, covered in wavy brown fur and bouncy cheeks. Yet there was something disjointed about it all, as though every part of his face was moving independently. Charlie fought to remain still, but her body was acting of its own accord, squirming and pulling to get away from the mouth opening up toward her. Freddy's face slid across the bed like a python. His head lost its shape as it folded outward, taking hold of her feet and beginning to swallow, moving slowly upward as she fought not to scream or fight. A giant arm reached up and clapped the side of the bed, shaking the room as it anchored itself and pulled the giant torso higher. Freddy's jaw made motions of chewing as the distorted face pulled Charlie's legs inside it, his cheeks and chin dislocating further. It no longer resembled a living thing. Panic took hold and Charlie screamed. She clenched her fists, but there was no longer a face to strike. There was only a squeezing and spiraling vortex of fur, teeth, and wire. Before she could struggle further, her arms were pinned to her side, trapped inside the thing. Only her head remained free. She gasped for a last breath, then was violently scooped up, consumed by the creature. Clay Burke stopped the car without slowing down. The brakes screeched as they fishtailed in the dirt. John was out of the car before Clay had gotten it under control, running up the hill toward the house.
"Around back,"
Clay said, catching up to John, his voice low and tight. They made their way around the house to the back door, which was gaping open.
"Check that way."
Clay gestured to his right as he ran left. John stuck close to the wall, peering into doorways as he passed them.
"Charlie," he cried. "Charlie,"
Clay echoed, entering the master bedroom.
"Charlie!"
John ran from room to room, moving faster.
"Charlie!"
He arrived at the front door. He swung it wide open and stepped outside, half expecting to catch someone fleeing the scene.
"Clay, did you find her?"
he shouted as he raced back inside. Clay walked briskly back into the living room, shaking his head.
"No, but she was here. The bed was unmade and there was dirt all over the floor. And these..."
He held up Charlie's sneakers. John nodded grimly, only now noticing the trails of dirt strewn through the house. He glanced again to the front door.
"She's gone,"
John said, his voice catching in his throat. He looked at the older man.
"Now what?"
he asked. Clay just stared at the floor and said nothing. Chapter 11.
"Clay!"
John repeated. His alarm grew as the older man stared down at the dirty floorboards, apparently lost in thought. John put a hand on his arm, and Clay startled. He looked as if he'd just realized he wasn't alone.
"We have to find her,"
John said urgently. Clay nodded, springing back to life. He broke into a run and John followed close at heel, barely making it into the passenger's seat before Clay started the engine and took off, speeding down the half-made road.
"Where are we going?"
John shouted. He was still struggling to close the door against the wind. It flapped like a massive wing, pulling against him as Clay swerved down the hill. Finally, John yanked it shut.
"I don't know," Clay said grimly. "But we know about how far they can get."
He drove wildly back down the hill and out to the main road, flipping on his police lights. They went less than a mile before he turned quickly onto a small, unpaved lane. John's shoulder banged hard against the door. He gripped his seatbelt as they barreled down the trail, high brush scraping the sides of the car and thumping the windshield.
"They have to come through here," Clay said. "This field is right in the middle of the path between that house and the next area on the map. We just have to wait for them."
He stopped the car abruptly and John jerked forward. Together, they got out of the car. Clay had stopped at the edge of an open field. There were trees scattered here and there, and the grass was tall, but there were no crops and no livestock grazed. John walked out into the open, watching the grass ripple like water in the wind.
"You really think they'll come by here?"
John asked.
"If they keep moving the direction they've been going," Clay said, "they have to."
Long minutes passed. John paced back and forth in front of the car. Clay positioned himself closer to the middle of the field, ready to run in any direction at a moment's notice.
"They should have been here by now," John said. "Something's wrong."
He glanced at Clay, who nodded. The sound of a car engine rose from the distance, growing louder. They both froze. Whoever it was, they were coming fast. John could hear branches whipping against the car's body in an irregular percussion. After a few seconds, the car shot out from the lane and screeched to a halt.
"Jessica."
John walked toward the car.
"Where's Charlie?"
Jessica asked, stepping out onto the grass.
"How did you find us?"
Clay demanded.
I called her, John put in quickly. From the restaurant, right after I talked to you.
I've been driving all over the place. I'm lucky I found you. Why are we stopped here?
Their route crosses through here, John explained, but she looked skeptical.
What does that mean? How do you know?
John glanced at Clay, neither of them looking confident.
They have her already, right? Jessica said. So why would they keep going toward her dorm?
Clay closed his eyes, putting a hand to his temples.
They wouldn't, he said.
He looked up at the sky, the wind battering across his upturned face with a raw touch.
So they could be going anywhere now, Jessica added.
We can't predict what they're doing anymore, John said. They got what they wanted.
And she wanted this? She planned this? Jessica said, her voice rising. What's wrong with you, Charlie?
She turned back to John.
They might not have even wanted her. It could have been anyone. So why did she have to go up there? Like some kind of...
Sacrifice, John said quietly.
She can't be dead,
Jessica muttered, her voice shaky even under her breath.
We can't think like that, John said sternly. We'll form a perimeter, Clay said. Jessica, you and John take your car and start driving that way, he pointed. I'll loop back in the other direction. We'll make circles and hope we catch them. I can't think of any other way.
He looked at the teenagers helplessly. No one moved, despite Clay's new plan. John could feel it in the air. They had all surrendered.
I don't know what else to do.
Clay's voice had lost its strength.
I might, John said abruptly, the idea forming even as he spoke. Maybe we can ask them.
You want to ask them? Jessica said sarcastically. Let's call them and leave a message. Please call us back with your murderous plot at your earliest convenience.
Exactly, John said. Clay, the mascots from Freddy's, are they all gone? When you say you threw them out, what does that mean? Can we get access to them?
He turned to Jessica.
They helped us before, or at least they tried to, once they stopped trying to kill us. They might know something, I don't know. Even if they're on a scrap heap somewhere, there must be something left. Clay?
Clay had turned his face up to the sky again. Jessica gave him a sharp look.
You know, don't you? She said. You know where they are.
Clay sighed.
Yeah, I know where they are.
He hesitated.
I couldn't let them be dismantled, he went on. Not knowing what they are, who they had been, and I didn't dare let them be casually tossed out, considering what they're capable of doing.
Jessica opened her mouth, about to ask a question, then stopped herself.
I kept them, Clay said.
There was a rare note of uncertainty in his voice.
You what?
John stepped forward, suddenly on guard.
I kept them, all of them. I didn't know about asking them any questions, though. Ever since that night, they haven't moved an inch. They're broken, or at least they're doing a good impression of it. They've been sitting in my basement for over a year now. I've been careful to leave them alone. It just seemed like they shouldn't be disturbed.
Well, we have to disturb them, Jessica said. We have to try to find Charlie.
John scarcely heard her. He was staring searchingly at Clay.
Come on, Clay said.
He set off toward his car with a heavy look, as if something had just been taken from him. John and Jessica exchanged a glance, then followed. Before they reached Jessica's car, Clay was already heading toward the main road. Jessica stepped on the gas, catching up just as Clay made a sharp right turn. They didn't speak. Jessica was intent on the road,
and John was slouched in his seat, thinking things through. Ahead of them, Clay had switched on his flashing lights, though he left off the siren. John stared into the darkness as they drove. Maybe he'd spot Charlie just by chance. He kept his hand loose on the door handle, ready to jump out, to run and save her. But there were only endless trees, scattered with the orange windows of distant houses, which hung on the hills like Christmas lights.
"We're here,"
Jessica said, sooner than John had expected. John pushed himself upright and peered out the window. She made a left turn and slowed the car down, and as she did, John recognized it. A few yards ahead was Carlton's house, surrounded by a cove of trees. Clay pulled into the driveway and they came in behind him. Jessica stopped the car inches from his bumper. Clay jangled his keys nervously as they approached the house. He looked like an altered man, no longer the assured police chief in control of every situation. He unlocked the door, but John hung back. He wanted Clay to go in first. Clay led them into the living room, and Jessica made a noise of surprise. Clay gave her a sheepish look.
"Sorry for the mess," he said.
John glanced around. The room was mostly the same as he remembered, full of couches and chairs all fanned around a fireplace. But both couches were piled with open files and stacks of newspapers, and what looked like dirty laundry. Six coffee mugs sat crowded together on a single end table. John's heart sank as he noticed two bottles of whiskey lying on their sides between an armchair and the hearth. He cast his eyes around quickly, spotting two more. One had rolled under a couch. The other was still half full, sitting beside a glass with a distinct yellow tinge. John snuck a look at Jessica, who bit her lip.
"What happened here?" she asked.
"Betty left," Clay said shortly.
"Oh."
"I'm sorry," John offered.
Clay waved a hand at him, staving off further attempts at comfort. He cleared his throat.
"She was right, I guess. Or at least she did what was right for her."
He forced a laugh and gestured at the mess that surrounded him.
"We all do what we have to do."
He sat down in a green armchair, the only seat completely free of paperwork and debris, and shook his head.
"Can I move these?"
John asked, pointing to the papers that filled the couch opposite Clay. Clay didn't respond, so John stacked them up and put them to one side, careful not to let anything fall. He sat, and after a moment, so did Jessica, though she eyed the couch as if she thought it might be carrying the plague.
"Clay,"
John started, but the older man started talking again, as if he'd never stopped.
"After all of you left, after all of you were safe, I went back for them. Betty and I had decided it might be a good time for Carlton to get out of town for a while, so she took him to stay with her sister for a few weeks. To be honest, I don't remember if she suggested it, or if it was me who put the idea in her mind. But as soon as I saw them pull down the driveway and out of sight, I got to work. Freddy's was locked up. They'd taken away Officer Dunn's body and completed their search, under my careful guidance, of course. They took some samples, but nothing else had been removed from the premises, not yet. They were waiting on me to give the go-ahead. The place wasn't even under guard. After all, there was nothing dangerous inside, right? So I waited for things to calm down. Then I drove to St. George and rented a U-Haul. It was raining when I picked up the truck, and by the time I got to Freddy's, there was a full-on thunderstorm, even though the forecast had been clear. I had keys this time. All the locks were police issue now, so I just walked right into the place. I knew where I would find them, or at least I knew where I'd left them, and prayed they were still here. They were all piled together in that room with the little stage.
Pirate's Cove, Jessica said, her voice barely a whisper.
I half expected them to be gone, but they were sitting patiently, like they'd been waiting for me. They're immense, you know. Hundreds of pounds of metal and whatever else was in there. So I had to drag them one by one. I loaded them all up eventually. I figured I would bring them down through the storm cellar. But when I got back home, the lights were on, and Betty's car was in the driveway. She'd come back from her trip early, it seemed.
What did you do? Jessica asked. She was hunched over, her chin in her palms. John shook his head, mildly amused. She was enjoying the story.
I waded across the street. I watched the lights, staking out my own house. When the last light went out, I pulled into the driveway and started dragging those things again, lowering them down into the cellar one by one. I drove the truck back to St. George and came back home, all without anyone seeing me. It would have never worked if I hadn't had the cover of thunder and lightning to mask what I was doing. When I came in, I was soaking wet and my whole body ached. All I wanted was to go upstairs to bed, next to my wife. He cleared his throat. But I didn't dare. I took a blanket and I slept in front of the basement door, just in case something tried to come out.
Did it? Jessica asked.
Clay shook his head slowly back and forth, like it had taken on extra weight.
In the morning, they were exactly the way I'd left them. Every night after that, I went down there when Betty was asleep. I watched them. Sometimes I even talked to them, trying to provoke them somehow. I wanted to make sure they weren't going to kill us in our sleep. I went back over the case files, trying to figure out how we'd missed Afton. How had he managed to come back without anyone suspecting? Betty could tell something was wrong. A few weeks later, she woke up and came looking for me. She found me, and them.
Burke closed his eyes.
I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but the next morning she was gone again, and this time she didn't come back.
John shifted on the couch restlessly.
They haven't moved since then? They're just sitting there like broken dolls. I don't even think about them anymore. Clay, Charlie's in danger, John said, standing. We have to go see them.
Clay nodded.
Well, then let's go see them.
He stood and gestured toward the kitchen. The last time John had stood in the Burke's kitchen was the morning after they'd all escaped from Freddy's. Clay had been making pancakes and kidding around. Betty, Carlton's mother, was sitting next to her son as if she were afraid to leave his side. They were all giddy with relief that the ordeal was over, but John could tell that each of them, in their own particular ways, was struggling with other emotions too. Someone might stop talking in mid-sentence, forgetting the rest, or stare for several moments at the empty air in front of them. They were all just barely recovering. But the kitchen had been bright. Light sparkled off the counters, and smells of coffee and pancakes were reassuring, a connection to reality. Now, John was struck hard by the contrast. There was a rank smell, and he could see immediately what it was. The counters and table were strewn with dirty dishes, all crusted with leftover meals. Most had scarcely been eaten. There were two more empty bottles in the kitchen sink. Clay opened the door to what looked like a closet, but turned out to be the basement steps. He flipped a light switch, illuminating a dim bulb right above the stairs, and motioned them in. Jessica started forward, but John put a hand lightly on her arm, stopping her. Clay went first, leading their descent, and John followed, guiding Jessica behind him. The stairs were narrow and a little too steep. Each time John stepped down, he felt a slight lurch, his body unprepared for the distance. Two steps down, the air changed. It was damp and moldy.
"Watch out for that one," Clay said.
John looked down to see that one of the boards was missing. He stepped over it carefully and turned, offering Jessica a hand as she made the awkward jump.
"One of the many things that's on my to-do list," Clay said offhandedly.
The basement itself was unfinished. The floor and walls were nothing but the unpainted inner surface of the foundation. Clay gestured to a dark corner where the boiler lurked heavily. Jessica gasped. They were all there, lined up in a row against the wall. At the end of the line, Bonnie slumped against the boiler. The gigantic rabbit's blue fur was stained and matted, and his long ears drooped forward, almost obscuring his wide, square face. He still held a red bass guitar in one enormous hand, though it was battered and broken. Half of his bright red bow tie had torn off, giving his face a lopsided look. Beside him sat Freddy Fazbear. His top hat and matching black bow tie were undamaged, their material only a little scuffed. And though his brown fur was bedraggled, he still smiled for an absent audience. His blue eyes were wide and his eyebrows raised, like something exciting was about to happen. His microphone was missing, and he held his arms out stiffly before him, grasping at nothing. Chico leaned against Freddy, her head drooping to the side. The weight of her yellow body, inexplicably covered in fur, not feathers, seemed to rest entirely on him. Her long, orange chicken legs were splayed out in front of her, and for the first time, John noticed the silver talons on her feet, inches long and sharp as knives. The bib she always wore had been torn. It had read, "Let's eat," but it was faded by time, along with the damp and mildew of the basement. John squinted at her. Something else was missing.
"The cupcake," Jessica said, echoing his thoughts.
Then he spotted it.
"There, on the floor," he said.
It was sitting alone beside Chica, almost huddled, its evil grin maniacal and pathetic. Set a little apart from the three was the yellow Freddy, the one that had saved all their lives. He looked like Freddy Fazbear, and yet he did not. There was something different about him besides the color, but if someone had asked John what it was, he knew he wouldn't be able to name it. Jessica and John looked at it for a long moment. John felt a sense of quiet awe as he studied the yellow bear.
"I never got to thank you," he wanted to say, but he found he was too scared to approach it.
"Where's—"
Jessica started, then cut herself off. She pointed to the corner where Foxy was propped against the wall, clothed in shadows but still visible. John knew what he would see, a robotic skeleton covered with dark red fur, but only from the knees up. It had been tattered even when the restaurant was opened. Foxy had his own stage in Pirate's Cove. As John peered at him now, he thought he could see more places where the fur covering was ripped, and the metal frame showed through. Foxy's eye patch was still fixed in place above his eye. While one hand drooped at his side, the arm with the large, sharpened hook was raised above his head, poised for a downward slash.
"Is this how you left them?"
John asked.
"Yep. Exactly how I left them," Clay answered, but he sounded suspicious of his own words.
Jessica approached Bonnie cautiously and crouched down to make her eyes level with the enormous rabbit.
"Are you in there?"
she whispered. There was no response. Jessica reached out slowly to touch his face. John watched, tensing, but as Jessica petted the rabbit, not even dust stirred in the mildewed basement. Finally, she straightened and took a step back, then looked helplessly at John.
There's nothing.
Shh, he interrupted. A noise caught his attention.
What is it?
John bent his head, craning closer to the sound, though he couldn't tell exactly where it was coming from. It was like a voice on the wind, words swept away before he could catch them, so that he couldn't be sure it was a voice at all.
Is anyone here? He murmured.
He looked at Freddy Fazbear, but as he tried to focus his attention, the sound situated itself. He turned to the yellow Freddy suit.
You're here, aren't you? He asked the bear.
He went to the animatronic and crouched in front of it, but he didn't try to touch it. John looked into its shining eyes, searching for any of the spark of life he had seen that night, when the golden bear entered the room, and they all knew as irrefutable fact that Michael, their childhood friend, was inside. John couldn't remember precisely how that knowledge had come. There was nothing behind the plastic eyes, nothing different physically. It was just pure certainty. He closed his eyes, trying to call it back. Maybe by recalling that essence of Michael, he could conjure him again. But he couldn't catch it, couldn't sense the presence of his friend as he had that night. John opened his eyes and looked at all the animatronics one by one, remembering them alive and mobile. Once, the children stolen by William Afton had watched him back from inside. Were they still inside now, dormant? It was horrible to think of them moldering down here, staring into the darkness. Something flickered in the yellow bear's eye, almost imperceptibly, and John drew in a sharp breath. He glanced behind, checking for a light that might have glanced off the hard plastic surface, but there was no obvious source. Come back, he pled silently, hoping to see the spark again.
John?
Jessica's voice pulled him back to reality.
John? I'm not sure that this was a good idea.
He turned toward her voice, then stood, his legs cramping. How long had he been there, staring into the blind eyes of the mascot?
I think there's still someone in there, he said slowly.
Maybe so, but this doesn't feel right.
She looked down from John toward the suits again. Their heads had moved. They tilted up unnaturally, facing John and Jessica. Jessica screamed, and John heard himself shout something unintelligible, leaping back as if he'd been stung. They were all looking directly at him. John took three experimental steps to the left, and they appeared to track him. Their eyes stayed fixed on him, and him alone. Clay had grabbed a shovel and was holding it like a baseball bat, ready to strike.
I think it's time to go. He stepped forward. Stop, it's okay, John exclaimed. They know that we aren't enemies. We're here because we need their help.
John opened his palms toward the creatures. Clay lowered the shovel, though he kept it in his hand. John looked at Jessica, who nodded rapidly. John turned back to the mascots.
We're here because we need your help, he said again.
They gazed back at him blankly.
Remember me?
He asked awkwardly. They continued to stare, as frozen in their new poses as they'd been before.
Please listen, he went on. Charlie, you remember her, right? You must. She's been taken by creatures like you, but not like you.
He glanced at Jessica, but she was watching anxiously, trusting this to him.
They were animatronic suits, buried under Charlie's house. We don't know why they were there.
He took a deep breath.
We don't think they were built by Henry. We think they were built by William Afton.
As soon as John said the name, the robots all began to shudder, convulsing where they sat. It was as if their machinery was being jump-started by a current too powerful for their systems to absorb.
John!
Jessica cried. Clay stepped forward and grabbed John by the shoulder.
We have to get out of here,
Jessica said urgently. The mascots were seizing wildly, their arms and legs jerking. Their heads banged against the back wall with painful clanks. John stood rooted to the spot, torn between the impulse to run to them, to try and help, and the urge to run away.
Go, now!
Clay shouted over the noise, pulling John backward. They made their way back up the basement stairs. Clay followed behind with the shovel raised defensively. John watched the mascots convulsing on the ground until they were out of sight.
We need your help to find Charlie,
he shouted one last time as Clay slammed the basement door and snapped three shiny new deadbolts shut.
Come on, Clay said.
They followed him, chased by hideous clanking and banging noises, only slightly muffled by the floor beneath. He led them back through the living room to a small study branching off from it, where he shut the door and bolted it.
They're coming up, John said, pacing and watching the ground beneath his feet.
Metal ground against metal. Something crashed like it was slammed against the wall. The echo reverberated through the floor.
Block the door, Clay ordered, grabbing one side of the desk in the corner.
John grabbed the other side as Jessica cleared a path for them, yanking two chairs and a lamp out of the way. They dropped it in front of the door as, beneath them, something scraped across the concrete like it was being dragged. Heavy footsteps shook the foundation of the house. The high-pitched whine of malfunctioning electronics filled the air, almost too high to hear. Jessica rubbed her ears.
Are they coming for us?
No, I mean, I don't think so, John said.
He looked to Clay for reassurance, but Clay's eyes were on the door. The whine intensified and Jessica clapped her hands over her ears. The footsteps grew louder. There was a noise like cracking wood.
At the door, Clay whispered.
There was a loud thud, and then another. John, Jessica, and Clay sank down behind the desk, as if it would better hide them. Another thud resounded, then a sound of splintering wood. The earth-shaking footsteps came closer. John tried to count them, to see if the creatures were all together, but there was too much overlap. They layered one over another, rattling his teeth and shaking through his chest. It felt like the sound alone might break him to pieces. Then quickly, the footsteps faded and were gone. For a long moment, no one moved. John gasped to breathe, realizing only now that he'd been holding his breath. He looked at the others. Jessica's eyes were closed, and she gripped her hands together so tightly that her fingertips had gone white. John reached out and touched her shoulder, and she jumped, her eyes flying open. Clay was already standing, tugging at the desk.
Come on, John, he said. Help me get this out of the way.
Right, he said unsteadily. Together, they shoved it aside and hurried out into the hall. The front door stood wide open to the night. John rushed out to look. The grass outside had been torn up where the mascots shuffled through it. The tracks were obvious and easy to follow, leading straight into the woods. John broke into a run, chasing after them, Clay and Jessica at his heels. When they reached the cover of trees, they slowed. In the distance, John saw a blur of movement for only an instant, and he motioned the others to hold back. They would follow, but they didn't dare be seen by whatever was leading the way.